Hello, hello, and a very warm welcome to the Steps to Investing podcast, bringing you the latest market news, company headlines, educational explainers, and expert interviews to help you invest for a better return. I'm Marcus De Silva. And a very warm welcome to episode 2 of season 6. This week we have got Ryan Hughes, a really fascinating guy, very senior at investment platform AJ Bell. And he is the chap who heads up their fund selection for basically these big portfolios that other professionals use, such as financial advisors. And in our interview, he's going to be imparting his wisdom on how you go about choosing some good funds, you know, how you find a good active manager amid all the quite average ones, as well as give us some of his favourites from over the years as well. So we've got 4 different buckets that we're going to be looking at there. Elsewhere in the podcast, we're going to look at the UK, US and Chinese markets in markets. We've got some details around ISA season in the explainer section, and we've got some headlines from some oil and gas companies, as well as some airline ones as well. Please subscribe and share, and don't forget our website, steps2investing.com. We've got plenty of articles, explainers, blogs, videos, jargon busters, all sorts of stuff, and there's of course the regular blog. Okay, let's start with the markets. 3 big themes in markets, and we're going to start with the UK economy, which has had some interesting sort of news, a splattering of news over the past fortnight. We'll start with some unflattering news from the IMF. That's the International Monetary Fund. This is an international financial institution, basically attached to the UN. And they came out, they do these forecasts about different economies, and they came out and they said that they expected the UK economy in 2023 to shrink by 0.6%. which was a big downgrade to their previous thinking and a big contrast to their forecasts about other major economies around the globe, which have all had their growth expectations increased more broadly, which again broadly is to do with the fact that consumer spending has remained quite robust in the face of inflation. It hasn't quite affected economies as economists thought that it might, the inflationary problem. So why the UK? Why are we under this horrible light from the IMF? Well, a few things. Big exposure to rampant energy prices. I'm sure you all would have felt that. But also other things as well. I'm afraid to say lack of workers because of Brexit and something that's been exacerbated by COVID. And also mortgage rates as well are beginning to sort of crimp on things a little bit. So bit glum there from the IMF. But then we heard from the Bank of England, who upgraded their forecast and said that we would go into recession. So that's 2 consecutive quarters of negative growth, technically, but that the recession would be shallower than expected in 2023. So that was a bit nicer. And then nicer again, we had the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, lovely snappy names of these institutions. And they said that there would be no recession at all, just a bit of a slump. So different kind of stories from different economic institutions. But, you know, a slew of data that seemed to get brighter over the course of the fortnight. Nonetheless, the real impact for much of middle and low-income Britain is that it's feeling the pinch from inflation. The average household finances are seeing disposable income dropping by 13% as we start to drain those lockdown savings. And this is going to hit firms in the economy that sell stuff that we can kind of avoid buying for the moment, right? So people are not going to bother with that new sofa or new extensions or other things like that. They're gonna be thinking about saving their pennies for socializing and holidays. So that will have an impact. I think the other worry is that we're seeing a bit of a slump in the housing market as well. Survey called RICS that showed there's much lower demand, but also that, you know, house prices have been falling and it's the longest slide since 2008. Although we are also starting to see some optimism there as well, as people start to expect falling interest rates. You know, the big problem was rising interest rates and not knowing how high they would go. So now that we're starting to see inflation falling, then the expectation is starting to filter through that at least interest rate rises should slow, and then at some point, probably next year, they'll start to fall. On to our second theme, and over the cross the pond to the US. I think one of the big bits of news that investors were waiting upon there was what the Federal Reserve, the US Central Bank, was going to decide about interest rate policy, to see whether it was going to ease off the pedal a little bit. We've seen sort of around 6 months of data that was showing that inflation was falling there. So, you know, the impact of this tighter monetary condition was seeming to be having the desired effect. And sure enough, on February 1st, as the market expected, they have reduced the size of those rises. So they said it was going to be a rise, but by just 0.25% to 4.75%. So as we expected, we're beginning to see a slight easing of those tighter conditions. The Federal Chair, Jerome Powell, said he could see disinflation starting to sort of ripple through the economy. So this is where there's still inflation, but the size of that increase is reducing now. So that's pretty pleasing for investors. The other thing that they seem sort of nervous on, though, is the fact that employment is still quite low. And, you know, that's great in a real sense, real people, we want to be in jobs. But just from an economic sense, it just makes officials a little bit nervous because labour can be a strong source of inflation. So I think they're still very much on their tippy toes. I think the other thing in the US, we're in the middle of earnings season. So every 3 months, companies will come to the market and tell the market how their business is doing, how sales are going, how their profits are. It's one of these, what we would call bottom up, it's from the companies themselves. It's these bits of information that can drive sort of individual company share prices. So this is one of the things that kind of, one of the bottom up factors that drives stock markets. The other thing, the other news that drives stock markets is those big top down bits of news. So we talked about, you know, things like central bank announcements, like the Fed had announced on interest rates, but other geopolitical things, wars and other things like that can also drive markets in a much more broad sense. So this is more individual in terms of how markets are driven. And this year it's been pretty mixed bag really in terms of profits and results from companies. I think one big surprise to note was Apple, which basically missed its sales and profits expectations. Sales dropped 5% and they were blaming problems with supply chains in China and production there. The other was Visa, which was doing quite well. And this was one of these great sort of inflationary stocks, actually. It's, you know, the business model is basically the infrastructure of payments around the globe, of digital payments around the globe, and they take a slice, they take a percentage of those transaction fees. So if prices are going up because of inflation, you know, that's what inflation is, prices are rising, then their revenues will rise in lockstep as well. The other thing about them is that they, you know, they don't need to worry about default. So whilst, you know, economic activity might lead to a drop in terms of how much people are spending, they're not worrying, they're not like a bank where they take on, they're giving out loans and they're worried about people defaulting on those loans. They're literally just the sort of middle person in terms of transactions. So it has been one of those stocks that have been quite popular in the recent environment, and in came their results and it had beaten what analysts expected. Okay, final thing we're going to look at in markets is China. So China, you know, it's a really exciting theme, China, this year. One of the big themes, really, in global investment, because it had been terrible for a couple of years. It had these very draconian COVID restrictions. It decided to go down this route of trying to beat COVID through zero transmission rather than, you know, working really hard to immunize the the population and create herd immunity through vaccines. So that was definitely a big mistake, and it had a big negative impact on its economy. This had a big rippling effect around the world, as I'm sure you all know, because of the fact that so many supply chains are embedded in China, and it is enormous. It represents 18% of global GDP, so it's nearly a fifth of the world economy, but an even bigger chunk of its growth because it's still maturing, whereas other big economies like the US are mature, so they're growing at a much slower clip. So it has this outsized ability to inject quite a lot of economic activity into what is at the moment quite a limp global economy. So, you know, all eyes are on China as to, okay, what's going to happen as these restrictions are lifted. There's some worries, because near-term worries, because whilst it's got an amazing potential, it's still got very high rates of infection. And, you know, there's a bit of tension between China and the West. There's worries about, you know, military ambitions towards Taiwan, and also the fact that President Xi has centralized, has sucked in a lot of power very centrally, that you know, particularly after the last party conference there. But we've actually seen some near-term risk, but we've seen some okay data actually over the past couple of weeks, which has been a bit of a relief. It's manufacturing activity, for example, expanded for the first time since September last year. We also saw unemployment go down, more people are in jobs, and also some of those supply chain issues, those log jams, seem to be easing. You know, waiting times are getting smaller, so that's quite good news both for China and also for global inflation as well. And it does seem as if the government is now quite focused on, okay, we need to restore economic growth to its potential, and that includes stimulus as well. I think the other surprise that sort of came out of China over the fortnight, though, was on the flip side to that, and talking about tensions with the West, I'm sure many of you would have seen this story, but the spy balloon that sort of wandered over the US continent. And do you know what? In the most brazen sort of manner, and it did cause a slew of hilarious reactions across US pundits as well. But the thought is that it is China basically being a bit bold and objecting quite publicly to many, many years of US spy planes, which, whilst flying over international airspace, take lots of pics of sensitive sites in China, and it really incenses the government. So it seems like this was a bit of a bold kind of objection to that kind of activity. All said, I'd say the mood over the fortnight is quite positive. I think if we were going to pick on one real thing here, it's that investors are starting to believe that inflation really is easing, and therefore central banks around the world will ease up on their rather tough stance, and that's going to be great for markets in general. So the S&P 500 is up 1.4% to 4,118 points. The FTSE 100 is up 2.4% to 7,945 points. The Shanghai Composite is up 0.93% to 3,270 points. And Europe's Stoxx 600 is up 2.2% to 464 points. Okay, on to the explainer, and I just wanted to offer a bit of reminders around ISAs, as we're kind of in this, what we call ISA season in the industry. And that's, so the ISA is just an investing account that has tax privileges that the government has created to incentivize us to save and invest. And they have a few different flavors, which I'll get onto in a sec. But essentially, if you go about doing some investing, then it can attract taxes, okay? So if you were to just open a normal account, what we call a general investment account, and you were to invest in some stuff, and the value of those investments were to grow, and then you were to click sell and crystallize those gains in a certain tax year, then if those gains were more than £12,300, you would pay capital gains tax on that. if you received income from investing in shares, dividends, and that was more than £2,000, and you pay taxes on that. Also, if you received interest from bonds or savings of more than £1,000, then you pay taxes on that. If you would do investing through a tax wrapper account like an ISA, or if it's retirement saving through a SIP, these are tax privileged. They are completely protected from any of those three taxes that I've mentioned. So they're very important to use. Of course, they come with some limits, otherwise we'd just be stuffing them with all the money that we had. And focusing on ISAs and the different flavours, very broadly, you have a £20,000 limit every tax year across the main ISAs. So the main ISAs are your cash ISA, your stocks and shares ISA. They're the main two, really. You know, one's obviously for cash, the other's for investing in the stock market through funds and shares and things like that. There's also the innovative finance ISA as well, which is for peer-to-peer loans. There is a fourth specific flavour of ISA called the lifetime ISA. So that is only between the ages of 18 and 39 can you open a lifetime ISA. You can only put up to £4,000 a tax year into it, and the government will give you a 25% bonus. But it can only be used for one of two things, either buying your first home or if you're beyond the age of 60. So a bit of a kind of retirement goal put in there as well. Nonetheless, that £4,000, the max £4,000, will come out of that £20,000 limit as well. So if, let's say, you had a lifetime ISA and you invested the £4,000, then you would still have a £16,000 out of your annual allowance to invest then in a cash ISA or a stocks and shares ISA. You can have as many of those flavours as you like within a single tax year. You can't open more than one of the same within a tax year, but you could across different tax years. So anyway, though, that's your contribution limit. That gets refreshed every new tax year, every April 6th. So the industry rushes to try and get people to use as much of those limits as possible before the new tax year ticks over. Why am I, I'm mentioning it now? Because, of course, that is the same every single year. But tax planning is particularly important this year. And that's because that capital gains tax-free allowance that I mentioned, 12,300, come April 6th, will reduce to £6,000. And that dividend tax-free allowance that I mentioned, the £2,000, that comes down to £1,000 come April 6th. And they both will reduce further as well the following tax year. So what the government are doing are removing basically tax incentives outside of the ISA structure or the SIP structure. So it's more important now, you know, particularly to get your investments within those tax wrappers now, particularly if you've got investments and potential tax liabilities in accounts that are not tax wrappered. You know, you need to get those into an ISA or a SIP. And I think, you know, with the ISA, there's a process called the bed in ISA process, which is, you know, in one fell swoop, any investments within a general account will be sold and rebought within an ISA structure. That doesn't mean you won't face tax liabilities if there are some. So if you had, you know, your whole pot had gains of more than £12,300, then you would still face taxes on that potentially. But that tax liability would get worse next come April 6th. So it's better now to if you do face a bit of pain, to take that pain and get investing through those really generous government incentivized ISAs. Just one final thing to mention is the junior ISA. You know, great idea if you're thinking about putting some money away for your kids, if you've got relatives who want to, you know, add a bit of cash to some fund for them for when they're older. That has a limit of £9,000 a year, a tax year, and it's separate to yours. So, you know, if you had lots of kids, that wouldn't impinge on your own £20,000 per year limit. Hopefully that all makes sense. Few figures there. Final few headlines before we get on to our interview with Ryan. Let's start with some of the oil and gas companies. You know, we heard from Shell and BP. I think, you know, the story is pretty much the same across the oil and gas companies, which is that they're making bumper profits on account of high energy prices, you know, largely because of this war in Russia. that particularly boosted their profits last year. You know, Shell made £32.2 billion last year. BP made £23 billion last year. Enormous rises. I mean, Shell's, that was the biggest in its history ever. So lots of chat always then is introduced around, you know, the windfall tax and whether that's sufficient. This was a tax first introduced. It was called the Energy Profits Levy. It was introduced at a 25% rate by the then Chancellor Rishi Sunak, who's now Prime Minister, obviously. Jeremy Hunt said that he would increase that to 35% from this year, January this year, and that he would extend it out from ending in 2025 to ending in March 2028. But so that's, I think that's good stuff, and it's right. You know, they expect that that should raise, I think it was around 40 billion over 6 years. But the other thing is that the oil and gas companies can do some accounting wizardry, and they can write off taxes against things like, decommissioning certain projects in the North Sea, for example. So they can write taxes off, and I think you know, there is some debate then about, you know, closing these loopholes so they actually pay the UK government the excesses in their profits, which, you know, that they don't really deserve. You know, the idea of a windfall, really. And I think it's an interesting argument. Of course, the other negative narrative that the oil and gas companies face is their impact on the environment. And it seems, you know, just from what they're saying, they're trying to counteract this by talking a lot about their investments in the energy transition. You know, some investors really believe that these companies are well placed to invest in the energy transition because they have these hydrocarbon assets that kick off so much cash, they can then, and they have a lot of, you know, engineering expertise, they can use both those things and create a green future. And of course they talk up their investments in renewables. BP says it's upped its investments in renewables by 8 billion. Shell was, you know, it's recently bought its biogas producer called Nature Energy, and it's investing in a joint venture with EcoEnd, I think it's pronounced, which is with a company in the Netherlands and developing offshore wind there. So that's interesting, but they are also increasing their investments in hydrocarbons as well. You know, BP is putting an extra 8 billion in renewables, but also an extra 8 billion in oil and gas investments as well. So, it's they're sort of playing both sides there, really. And they argue that the investment in hydrocarbons is needed to ensure energy security. And it was much the same story from Norway's state-owned oil company, Equinor. They are benefiting hugely from high energy prices, but also replacing a lot of the gas that Russia is no longer pumping into Europe. So they're pumping 8% more gas into Europe from their farms. And again, you know, they're talking about their investments in renewables, big wind farm they're investing in off the northeast coast of England. So, you know, interesting stuff there. I think the thing about Norway is Equinor is state-owned and it has a very progressive taxation system. So, you know, I think from the latest set of announcements, their bumper profits, they were taking just shy of 50 billion anyway. So, you know, they tax it in a lot more progressive ways. So they are actually genuinely, the government is directly benefiting, you know, from that windfall, and then and also investing it in their big state-owned sovereign wealth fund, which is the biggest in the world, over $1 trillion. Very interesting fund. So there's a bit from the oil and gas side of things. Airlines, I think, we heard from a couple of the low-cost airlines, so Ryanair and EasyJet, and similar story from both of those. So they seem to have bounced back quite well from the pandemic lows. They have, you know, fended off some headwinds from the cost of living crisis. You would think that would affect spending on holidays, but it seems with consumers having had a few years of COVID and no holidays, as I sort of said earlier in the pod, they're prioritizing holidays and not spending it on other things, even though, you know, their income is being reduced. And of course, if you're trying to save the pennies as well, you're going to focus on the lower cost airlines as well. So that seems to be benefiting both of those airlines. They've had problems, you know, they're facing headwinds from high fuel costs. They've also had staffing issues, but it seems as if some of those staffing issues will be relieved because we saw the collapse of low-cost airline Flybe, and they'll be able to scoop up some of the staff that have been made redundant there. Okay, so that's some headlines there for you. Let's get on to our interview with Ryan. Well, hello to all of our listeners and also our viewers on YouTube. This is the Steps to Investing podcast, and I'm your host, Marcus De Silva. Today, we're going to be exploring how to set about finding some really good actively managed funds for your ISA, maybe your SIP, as opposed to just selecting cheap index passive tracker. So actively managed funds is where you've got a stock picker, a human stock picker, who is selecting certain companies out of a particular market with the idea that that collection of companies will beat the market that they're selecting them from. And I wanted to explore this because there's a lot of them out there. There's about 5,500 funds. There's about 400 investment trusts out there. And the figures frequently show that the majority do not beat the sort of passive equivalents after fees. So that said, a really good active manager can certainly grow your wealth way beyond a passive. So it's really important to select a really good active manager. So I've got someone on the podcast to help with exactly that. He spent his career analysing funds. He's the head of investment partnerships at AJ Bell, and he's back on the pod. I'd like to welcome Ryan Hughes. Ryan, welcome.
Hi there. Thanks very much for having me back.
Should we start with some background, Ryan? How long have you been looking at funds for?
Yeah, I suppose the formal part of my career, I've been fund researching for probably about 20 years, probably 20 years this year, but it goes back, my career goes back longer than that. We're approaching 25 years now, which means I've seen a few crises and a few cycles. So I'm starting to feel my age, to be honest with you.
Okay, interesting. So I wanted to start with you, you know, when we're thinking about choosing some funds for our portfolios, what is your view on this kind of, I mean, it's much talked about, this sort of active versus passive, the kind of index debate. What's your view on this?
Yeah, I think in many respects, the debate has become, it's almost become too polarized. I don't like the narrative of active versus passive, which tends to be how it's always framed. It really should be, in my view, active and passive. Now, if you'd asked me 20 years ago what my view was, I'd have said it's very much active versus passive, because I was kind of trained to think that active managers could deliver outperformance consistently. And therefore, if you're researching investments, it's a kind of dereliction of duty if you went down the passive route. But things have moved on a lot over the last 20 years. The beta element, so buying market exposure, buying a passive, has become so much cheaper. And that makes the bar for good active managers higher, and the bar for bad active managers even higher and even harder for them to achieve. So, but I do think it's really important that we think about how they can work in harmony. Maybe passive is right for some asset classes. Maybe it's active is right for other asset classes. Maybe passive is right for some investors. And active may be right for others, because it's really important if you do look at you want to invest in an active strategy, that you're it's not a kind of one and done. We buy it and we forget about it, because things change. So if you're prepared to do your homework and keep on top of your homework, active management can be a really interesting place to look. But if you're not, and you're not that way inclined, I'll be the first to say to anyone, buy passive, keep it simple, keep it low cost. But if you're really interested in buy investments and you want to engage with it, then I think there's some interesting places to use active management.
Okay, let's move on to finding some really good active funds then. There's a few different things that we can look at, and I'm going to start with performance, because the regulator makes it clear that, you know, past performance is not a guide type thing. How important is performance to you?
Performance for me is about informing me as to how the manager invests. Actually, you can use the shape of the performance, the type of performance that you get, to actually educate you as to how the manager invests, what their style is, what their process is, where their biases lie. Because let's get it right out of the way up front. There is no single active manager that will ever be able to outperform every single year. The very best in history will go through long periods of underperformance, and the underperformance might be quite stark. So you've got to go into it with the right frame of mind, in knowing that any active investment you select will have a period of underperformance. The key is understanding when that underperformance should happen and is likely to happen, and therefore, can you tolerate that within your portfolio? So we do think about performance. I do look at performance, but in many respects, it's one of the last things I think about, not one of the first things I think about, because I want to understand how a manager invests first and foremost. And I simply use performance and past performance as a way of educating me as to whether I've really understood that.
Okay, so I suppose there are periods of time where, you know, a manager might have a particular way of investing, a particular style, and there are periods of time in markets where styles can be out of favour. So during those times, you might expect certain managers to underperform. Just on the performance thing, though, do you think generally it's quite good to look at long-term performance? Because that's the really important time frame. You know, we always say that investing is about the long term. So I suppose if you're looking over the long term, that presumably is quite a good indicator of whether or not this manager is going to be able to deliver what you need for your financial goals.
It is. I mean, long term is absolutely key. But what I would think about the long term is perhaps longer than many investors would think about, because really what you're saying is you need a market cycle. If you've only got one type of style that's in favour for a prolonged period of time, then it will be no surprise if a manager that doesn't follow that style actually underperformed for quite a prolonged period. And these styles can last a long time. There might be one style in favour for 5 years plus, in which case some managers will underperform for quite a prolonged period. So long-term performance, looking at that, is really important. But you've got to look at it in the context of what's going on in the broader market as well.
Okay, well, let's get on to the fund manager themselves. I mean, what sorts of characteristics, what types of things do you look for when you're looking at the bios and you're looking at the fund manager themselves?
Yeah, I guess I'm really lucky compared to a lot of investors, and I get to talk to these fund managers and interview them face to face and get to know them over a period of time. So when I'm analysing them and thinking about them, it's not just about thinking about how they invest, in terms of thinking about their performance or their style or the type of companies they have in their portfolio, which anyone can, they can get the information from the internet and fact sheets and so on. I'm really lucky and I get to look them in the whites of the eyes and think about, do they come across as honest? Have they got a hunger and a desire to learn? Are they humble when things are going well? What's their behaviours when things are going badly? So these are all things that I can draw out in my interaction with fund managers on a regular basis. And that of course, that relationship builds up over time. But it is much harder for an investor that doesn't have access to fund managers to be able to draw, in many respects, those softer elements, those more human elements out of it. Because at the end of the day, they are all, every fund manager, there's people. Even if you're buying investing in a fund that's run by a computer, there's still a computer programmer behind the scenes telling it what to do. So you can't get away from the human element. And every single human has got behavioural weaknesses and behavioural biases. What we're trying to do is identify what those are and really try and minimise them, use managers that recognise those weaknesses. And I can perhaps give you a good example to bring this to life. There's a manager, a UK equity manager, who's very well known, who has a very particular style investing in value companies. And obviously that's not been a great place to be for quite a long period of time, but it's been better more recently. Now, he engaged an external consultant to analyse every single trade they'd done over a 10-year period to try and work out where their own strengths and weaknesses were there and try and actually improve their decision-making. Now, for me, when I'm talking to fund managers, that is a brilliant thing to see, because you want to see that that degree of engagement of wanting to improve the decisions. But it's not about finding fund managers that get every decision right. The best fund managers in history are likely to have only got between 50 and 60% of their individual company picks correct. So nearly half of them are going to go wrong. The hit rate, as it's termed, if you've got a hit rate above 50%, 60%, that's pretty good over time. And even the great investors, your Warren Buffetts and so on, will have made many, many mistakes over a very long period of time.
So I suppose if you can find content, materials, videos that enable you to listen to the fund manager and to some extent, like you do, look them in the whites of their eyes and get a sense of whether you trust what they're saying and their beliefs behind their investment process, that's probably quite a useful thing when you're exploring, looking at funds for your portfolio.
Absolutely. You've got to use more than past performance. And they're absolutely right. Past performance isn't a guide to the future. What the way that we would think about past performance is it gives us a frame of reference as to the type of performance you should expect. When should it do well? When should it do badly? And the more you can read about fund managers' comments about how what they're thinking of the world and their fund, the more videos you can watch, the more you can upskill yourself and immerse yourself in that, the better investor you're going to be.
So I suppose tenure is probably quite an important factor here.
Yeah, I mean, tenure is, for me, when I think about my investments and the funds that we will use in clients' portfolios, I suspect if I looked at it, there's quite a lot of grey hair in the portfolio. We like managers that have seen a few crises that really because it's over those type of events that you shape who you are as an investor. I mean, I remember starting out around the tech crash. I started just before technology crash. So that immediately that's going to shape me as an investor. And then we had 9/11, and then we had the Iraq war and so on. And all of these events shape you as an investor and make you hopefully a better investor over time. So if we've got managers that have got long tenure, then we've got more evidence to look at that they stick to what they say they're going to do. We've got more evidence to hopefully identify whether it's skill, not luck, that's driving the performance over the long term. Because over the short term, anyone can be lucky. Being lucky over a long period of time, we all know that's not really going to happen.
How much do fees matter?
Fees do matter a lot, and they matter more and more, I would say. And that's really because of the point I made earlier around low-cost passive investing actually getting cheaper and cheaper. There's been a price war going on in the passive market for the last 5 or 6 years, and costs are being driven down. We're not really seeing much evidence of that in active management. And as I said, that just brings the bar higher and higher. I mean, ultimately, every investment you make, your first thought should be, how much does it cost me to get that exposure, i.e. a passive? So if I'm buying the FTSE All Share, how much is it going to cost me? Well, FTSE All Share might cost me around 10 basis points to get exposure to, 0.1% per annum. Okay, well, now I'm interested in active manager, but that active manager charges 0.8% per annum. Well, you've immediately got a decision. Do you think that manager over a period of time can outperform the market by 0.7% per annum? And that's a pretty high bar. Now, they won't do it every year, and some years they might beat it by 3, 4, 5%. Others, they might underperform by that amount. But on aggregate, they need to beat the market by 0.7% every year just to match the market. So that is going to be a very difficult challenge for them. So the hurdle rate for active versus passive is very important. And of course, these numbers differ for different asset classes. Bonds have become very, very cheap to buy in a passive structure, very cheap more recently. And of course, the degree of the ability to outperform is perhaps reduced because the kind of levers that a bond manager has to pull are not as extensive as an equity manager. The impact of the bond is not as great on a portfolio if they pick a good one.
Okay, finally, just before we move on to some of your favourite fund managers, the investment approach. Now, you briefly touched on value there being sort of a good time for value at the moment, and this is after a long period really throughout, ever since the financial crisis right the way up to the pandemic, where growth, well, actually, and beyond the pandemic, where growth was really the in favour kind of style. But it can be a bit complex for private investors to understand the difference between all these different styles. Do you think this is very important when it comes to selecting funds?
I think it's absolutely crucial to understanding active fund management, because essentially, it, when you boil down any active fund manager, they have some kind of style bias. It might not be value or growth. It might be large cap versus small cap. You can slice and dice the market in different ways. But ultimately, just about every single manager will have a bias to some degree or another. There are very, very few managers, I think, that have been able to successfully navigate a changing market over a long period of time. So successfully positioning their portfolio for growth and then calling the end of the growth phase and moving it to value, and then back and back round that circle we go. I don't think there are really any managers that I know of in my career that have consistently got that right time and time again. In which case, you then got to think about, okay, how do I combine different styles of management in my portfolio? Do I want to have a value manager, a manager that focuses on those companies that perhaps are a little bit out of favor and perhaps a little bit old fashioned, but are still making money, or a growth investor that's thinking about the latest exciting things going on in the market and maybe something like technology? Maybe actually a strategy, rather than trying to find one that can move between these different parts, is to actually combine managers together. So you've got a specialist manager on one side and a specialist manager on another side. And actually, you would hope that one of those is performing reasonably well at any time when you look at your portfolio.
So, because it can be a bit complex. We've got an awful lot of things that we need to think about when we're creating a balanced portfolio, and you've got a balance across markets, across different assets, across different styles. And I suppose that's the only thing, it can become a little bit confusing when you're sort of trying to create something that is diversified, which is really ultimately the key thing when you're investing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, investment and building a portfolio is a jigsaw puzzle. When you start a jigsaw puzzle, you've got your box full of pieces. You don't know which ones are the corner pieces and which ones are the edge pieces and so on. And you've got to root around and find them. But you're building your portfolio is no different to that. You've got to work out the types of funds that are going to be your corners. They're going to be the kind of anchor points in your portfolio. Then perhaps you want something that's a little bit more steady, which is going to be your edge pieces of your jigsaw puzzle. And then you can think about the more interesting things that are going to make up the nice picture in the middle. So if you can start imagining the different strategies as different parts of your puzzle, as different building blocks, then I think it's easier to think about how do you combine different strategies. But I would say one of the mistakes that we see quite often is the illusion of diversification. So we look at someone's portfolio and they think they're very diversified because they may have 10 or 15 different holdings. But if they're all invested in the same types of company, there's no diversification at all. So what we saw up until recently was portfolios that had lots of different holdings and they were all focused on growth. And they'd done really, really well because growth had done well. And then all of those holdings did badly at the same time. So you had that illusion of diversification. So you've really got to think about, if I'm wrong, which bit of my portfolio will do well? Which one or two or three holdings will prosper if my general ideas are wrong? So it is complicated, but then I would say if people think it's complicated, they should do a couple of things. They should either buy passive and not worry about it, or buy some kind of multi-asset strategy that does that for you, thinks about the asset allocation, thinks about the building blocks, combines different strategies together, and takes that problem away from you, because it's a full-time job for me, and it's enabled me to have a career. And you never stop learning in this. You've never cracked it. It really is quite complicated, and it feels ever more so right now in the kind of turbulent world that we're living in.
Okay, well, let's get on to some of your favourite fund managers of all time. You've certainly seen quite a lot of them over the years. So, and I'm going to do this there's a few ways of looking at this, but I'm going to do this from a sort of risk perspective. So we're going to have a look at cautious and moderate, adventurous and an income type idea, just to give people a few different flavours. So let's start in the cautious end. What would you, first of all, can you just quickly define what we might, you know, a cautious investor, and then what would you say would be quite a good pick in this sort of area?
Yeah, cautious investors. So we're thinking about people that might be making their first steps in the world of investing. They're moving out of cash. They might be taking out their first investment ISA, or they're just really nervous about investments and don't want to risk too much of their capital. And there are lots and lots of options in this space. You could invest in corporate bonds and government bonds. You could invest in a mix of different strategies. You could even maybe invest in some lower risk equities in that space. So there is quite a broad spectrum of cautious, which will mean different things to different people. For me, a manager that I've respected for a very long period of time, who runs a strategy in this way, is Sebastian Lyon at Troy. He runs the Personal Assets Investment Trust, as well as the Troy Trojan Fund. Now, Sebastian thinks long and hard about not losing money. So the first objective of the Personal Assets Investment Trust is preservation of capital. The second objective is, can I grow that capital? So you can immediately see there's a very clear alignment with that cautious risk profile in how they think about that. Now, Sebastian combines high quality equities with some fixed interest, with some bonds, with some gold and some cash. So if you buy something like Personal Assets, any investor is getting an instant portfolio. You're getting exposure to different asset classes taking some of the headaches that we've just been talking away from you. And when you look at the long-term track record of Sebastian, whether it be his open-ended fund in Troy or his investment trust for personal assets, what you should see and what you will see is it performs very well when markets are falling. When times are tough and things are really uncertain, he's got a strategy that manages to protect investors from the worst of those falls.
Well, I'm just going to quickly jump in there and say, well, if that's the case, how did he do last year?
Well, it was a little bit tougher last year. It was tough for everyone last year, which is a really good point. So fixed interest sold off last year, as well as equities. Gold was a little bit better. And some of the bonds, the index-linked bonds, the inflation-linked bonds, in the end recovered quite strongly. So the trust was down. It wasn't down as much as the equity market. But it again proof that no matter how good the fund manager, there is no way of constantly delivering positive returns in a market that which is very, very challenging. But coming back to that long term, coming back to that environment of thinking about that long term, then Sebastian has that approach. He's a long term thinker. He worries lots about risk and losing money, and I think that's a really good starting point for a lot of investors.
Okay, let's dial up a little bit the risk and go to the moderate area. So how do you define moderate investors?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. I was thinking about this. This is, it really does can span all kinds of things. I mean, I guess if we think of it as more of a balanced type investor, in my mind, you know, if you think of it at a scale of 1 to 10, we're in the kind of 4, 5 and 6 realm, which is probably pushing us towards some equities. Some equity exposure here, and that's where I've thought about a manager that I like in this space, and that would be Alex Wright, who manages the Fidelity Special Situations Fund and the Fidelity Special Values Investment Trust. Now Alex has got a lot of experience. He's been around a long period of time, so it kind of comes back to the conversation we were having of ticking that box. What I like about Alex is his process is very consistent and very repeatable in that he's very clear about the types of companies he wants to invest in. So he's a value investor. He's happy to invest in companies that other people are selling and shunning because he sees long-term potential in these companies. He's also happy to invest not just in the largest companies, but invest down the market capitalization. So there is a little bit of exposure to smaller companies in this type of strategy. But again, this is a manager that has over a long period of time, despite the fact his style has been out of favour for a good chunk of that time, shown that high quality active management can deliver outperformance versus the benchmark. Now, as ever, it's an equity fund. It doesn't look like the benchmark. So it will be volatile. By the very definition of active management, if you want a genuinely active manager, you have to expect the returns are going to be different to the benchmark in the first place. So if you're not comfortable with that, comes back to this, buy passive if you don't want that. But if you understand that it will look different, some years it'll be 10% behind, other years it may be 15% ahead. So you will get that volatile return profile. But Alex, he ticks the box on me of experienced, a very clear process, backed by a well-resourced team, and a very clear conviction in investing consistently in the same style.
Okay, Alex, right there, Fidelity. So let's move on then to the adventurous investor. I mean, how adventurous are we talking? How exotic are the asset classes in the adventurous?
Yeah, I've kept it relatively sensible in thinking about Asia for an adventurous investor, rather than thinking about some really high risk investment, a specialist niche investment. So I've stayed mainstream, but of course, adventurous spans the wide risk there of, you know, some really, really exciting, interesting, maybe something like investing solely in Vietnam or solely in a single sector. I think that might be a step too far for a lot of investors. I would think about those types of investments when you've got a very established portfolio already. Whereas I think for some people who just want to take a little bit more risk, an area like Asia is quite an interesting area to think about, because you've still got, it's very, you can relate to it, and it's got those nice long-term growth dynamics. So the manager I picked, it might sound slightly strange in that I'm not, in many respects, I'm not picking a manager, I'm picking a team, but only because the manager who ran this team for the last 20 years has just retired. And that was Matthew Dobbs at Schroders, who ran their Asian team. But he's been replaced a year ago by Richard Sennett there. And Richard has worked alongside Matthew for, more than a decade there. So when Richard took over, there was perfect continuity of process and the team and so on. So Richard runs a couple of strategies, but the one I kind of name check would be the Schroder Asian Alpha Plus Fund. And it's also got a mirroring investment trust of the Schroder Asia Pacific Investment Trust. So here, Schroders have got fantastic heritage of investing in Asia. They've got people on the ground in China and Hong Kong and across Asia. So they've got good resource. They've got kind of the depth of team and experience that's important there. And again, a process which is a little bit more focused towards growth. But what you see again is consistency of performance there. They're not shooting the lights out when they're winning, but equally, if they get it wrong, they're not getting it wrong by too much. And so you can have exposure to the Asian markets. Again, a manager, kind of, you'll see this consistent theme, a very experienced manager, backed by a very experienced and deep team who have a process that's well established and got the kind of war wounds of all the troubles that have happened in across markets over the years. So it's adventurous, but it's not gung-ho adventurous. It's got exposure to China. It's got exposure to Hong Kong, and that won't suit everybody given the types of things that are happening in that region. But I think the long-term growth drivers behind Asia are really appealing, and the team at Schroders have shown that process has got longevity and can stand the test of time with almost whatever's been thrown at it for the last 20 years, which in Asia is a lot.
Yeah, so I was going to ask, you know, when you move into more developing markets as opposed to developed markets, that's, you know, you're taking more risk for potentially more reward. Just why is it riskier to be in those markets? Just so that our listeners can sort of understand why it is that's the case.
I mean, if you are getting away from investing in, say, the UK, then immediately as soon as you invest overseas, you are introducing things like currency risk. So yeah, it's not just the performance of the underlying company that's going to drive your returns. It's actually then the performance of sterling versus whichever overseas currency you are exposed to. So you're introducing a different risk. You're introducing different accounting standards. You're introducing different cultures in terms of how business is done. You're introducing very much in different demographics that are involved here. Now, I think there was a school of thought for a very long period of time that if you went to countries like Asia and emerging markets, you were taking significantly more risk because who knows how business is done over there. And yeah, these are kind of questions that I remember when I was sat in meetings years and years ago, the kind of things that accusations would have been thrown. But I think now if we sit here and look at we look at the last 20 years, developed markets have had their fair share of corporate scandals. They've had bankruptcies, they've had outright frauds. You know, we're in no position to kind of sit here and moralize about accounting standards and how you run businesses there. So I think those risks, you kind of just have to accept that it's an investment risk and it's not particularly higher or lower compared to investing here. But obviously investing in a country like China, you are introducing some other risks, obviously around the way the government operates in China is very different to the UK and the US and so on. So there are more risks in some respects, but they are also different risks, the types of risks that you face when you're investing in something like a UK equity fund.
Okay, and then the final area that I wanted to look at was income. We have had quite a long period of time, more than a decade, where income from bonds wasn't great, and a lot of investors opted therefore for dividends, for income from shares. But the situation's changed a bit now with interest rates having risen and yields having risen. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are here and what you would suggest.
Yeah, but bonds I think are interesting again. Yeah, bonds are now offering yields that are attractive relative to cash, and you're being compensated for the risk that you are taking. So, in the income space, I've selected a manager here who I've known a very long time called Stephen Snowden, who runs the Artemis Corporate Bond Fund. Now this is an investment grade corporate bond fund, so it focuses on the higher quality companies that are issuing bonds in the UK or overseas. But they remove the currency risk by hedging that back to sterling. So you're not taking some of that currency risk we just talked about. Now, Stephen he ticks a lot of the boxes for me on those softer human characteristics. He is really tenacious. He wants to win. He never stops learning. And he's very, very humble when he's doing well. And he's honest enough to admit when he's got it wrong. So I like those characteristics in the manager. They come out, again, I've known him a very long period of time. He's someone I've invested with for my clients we're 2023. So I'm going to say almost the full 20 years I've been investing with Stephen Snowden as a corporate bond investor. And so I built up that trust and that relationship with him. I think he's a very, very good fixed interest manager. He's now hugely experienced, 20 years more so than when I first started investing with him there. And he's built a nice team at Artemis who are hungry to win. And you're getting a yield of more like 4 to 5% on investment grade corporate bonds today, whereas if we'd had this conversation a year ago, it would have been more like 2. So things have changed a lot in that space. But I think he's an example of an active fund manager who understands what he's doing and can deliver for investors.
Okay, well, just a final thing to say to our listeners and viewers, of course, these are not recommendations, they're just some ideas from Ryan here. Ryan Hughes, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a very big thank you to Ryan Hughes once again for joining me on the podcast. I think he's an amazingly experienced fund selector, has a lot of experience investing client money, and I think just that view that he has on how you sort of assess a fund manager's process and then see through its performance how it's kind of applied over time, and also how the fund managers react to different events over different cycles. I just thought absolutely spot on there. Next week, we have Becky O'Connor from PensionBee, and she's going to be discussing pensions, unsurprisingly. Until then, goodbye.